Accession number 18802, reel 24.
Brigadier Cowan, reel 24. You were about to describe the situation in Londonderry under 24th Brigade and what was going on there, what sort of military operations were being conducted when you arrived.
Well, I think the best way of describing operations is to say that they were reactive, and that if things were quiet, the last thing one wanted to do was to provoke things. And the presence of British soldiers in places where they weren't all that welcome some of the time didn't really help the scene. And so although we had people lurking, parked in ready-made places so they could emerge quickly when required, quick reaction forces, let's call them, we didn't have a regular daily routine for control, to use your word. Some patrols took place, yes. Some roadblocks, you know, mobile roadblocks from time to time took place, yes. But these were aimed at sort of disrupting people who might have been trying to move arms and things more than anything else. But as far as the city itself was concerned, until there was an uproar, which did happen fairly regularly, we tried to keep soldiers as calm as possible and out of the public view as much as possible.
Was it the case at that stage you were under the control of the police, or was it the case that you were entitled to act on your own initiative?
Very interesting question. I don't think I was ever given any formal instructions on this matter at all, but because, if you remember, the overall scene in 1969, the RUC were defeated, and the RUC were exhausted, and the RUC needed help urgently. Now, against that background, and because, you know, I appeared as a brigade commander, etc., etc., I am afraid I regarded it as my duty to be in command. And so there was no question of it, as it were, being under police command. If anything, they were under my command. But we didn't put it like that. We didn't play it like that. We played it as a partnership. But I was quite clear that any initiative came from the military side, and not from the police side.
Did the police accept that?
I think so. Because our relationship was very good, and we didn't press it. We didn't say, you're a Shah and we're going to do so and so and so and so. We said, we're all in this together. Our joint duty is to uphold the law. How are we going to do it?
Do you think that this was really a product of this close working relationship, a product of your good personal relations with Frank Lagan?
Yes, without doubt. And indeed, I'm told, and I must be very careful what I say because I wasn't there, but I'm told that my successor, in due course of time, was not on speaking terms with Frank Lagan. Well, I don't know.
This is a matter really of personnel policy and selection, isn't it?
Yes.
You use the phrase uphold the law. Now, in situations of civil disturbance, the phrase keeping the peace is more often used than upholding the law.
Yes. I use the phrase uphold the law because I use it against a background of people like the Orange Order, the Apprentice Boys, claiming the right to march X, Y, and Z wherever. I mean, it's rather like Dumcree now. You know, we've always marched the walls of Londonderry. We should go on marching the walls of Londonderry, and nobody's bloody well going to stop us. I can remember them saying words to that effect.
And based on custom.
Based on custom, based on rights, so-called, etc. And on tradition. Now, I understand all that very well, but if you're doing it in full view of of an aggressive and hostile Catholic population. It seems to me it's not contributing to the overall peace of the situation. And so, you know, we made it our business to make sure it didn't happen. When I say we, I mean the police and the army jointly. And I can well remember one day, I'm looking ahead now to the following year, but there was a day when the apprentice boys were going to do something or other in Londonderry. And we said, well, now you can do it on the far side of the river, the water side. You can have a march there to your heart's content, but you mustn't cross the river, etc., etc.
Not into the bog side?
Yeah. Absolutely not into, not at all, but not into the Protestant bit of the city of Londonderry either, on the west of the Foyle. And we had very, very particular arrangements to make sure that we could hold the line that we'd selected to be held. We nearly lost it once, but in that sort of situation, people kept saying to us, we had a sort of press conference beforehand to sort of explain what we were going to be up to. And various people said, you know, what are your plans? And Frank and I said, look, you won't expect us to disclose our plans. All we will say is we are here to uphold the law. And we will do that to the best of our ability, which seemed to be a reasonable solution to the problem and a reasonable answer to the question. And that's why I use that phrase rather than to keep the peace.
Another phrase that's often used in such circumstances is maintaining order, which of course sometimes entails breaching the law in a strict sense.
Yes, I suppose to an extent we did. I'm dodging about month to month a little bit, but I think it doesn't matter. If you take the Paisley episode in Londonderry, yeah, that's all right. He came, as I said, in February and October every year to stir things, and he would not be dissuaded, knowing full well there'd be riots for 3 days, and 3 days is what happened both in February 70 and October 70. But although it was getting better by then, and we were getting it more under control. Now, to picture the scene, we had soldiers all over the place, we had policemen all over the place, we had barbed wire and so on to prevent. There was one particular street out of the bog side where people could surge down, and traditionally did, and indeed it's roughly where the RUC got defeated. They surged down into the Guildhall Square and, you know, upset the Paisley meeting and so on. And so we had barbed wire all over the place to try and dissuade people. But there was a little boy, I don't know, that size, six, seven or whatever he was, foaming at the mouth, broke through all the barriers, all the police, all the soldiers, all the barbed wire and everything, and went steaming across the square, shouting, burn the bastards, burn the bastards. Well, now, somebody taught him that, and to me, it absolutely personified what was going on in Londonderry and Northern Ireland. I mean, that was the history. And, you know, when you told people that story in simple language, they were horrified. But I said, you know, this is happening every day. It's what people are being taught. And what are you going to do about it, oh, local people? Having asked that question, of course, we didn't really make much progress.
Didn't get an answer.
We didn't get an answer, no. But I was highly impressed by that scene.
You mentioned the mob surging out of the bog side to go and attack the meeting in the Guildhall Square. How much did you know about the activists or extremists on both sides of the sectarian divide when you went in? Did you have any stock of intelligence, personality intelligence in particular, or were you picking it up as you went along, once you'd arrived?
More or less picking it up as we went along. And, I mean, there were one or two people who we knew by name.
Yes.
Who were, call them activists. I mean, there were two Amons, I remember. Amon, I forget their other names now. But we thought they were both stirrers. They would deny it. They would say they were journalists and they were sort of good political correspondents, etc., etc. But they were stirrers. No, I think we just picked it up as we went along. But I think an awful lot of it was just the feeling in the Bogside and in the Cregan that everybody is anti-us, whether it's the Brits, whether it's the people in Stormont, whoever, everybody's anti-us. We don't get any jobs, we don't get any, etc., etc. And we'll create mayhem. We've got used to this civil rights business. We rather like chucking stones and bricks and things. Sadly, it became petrol bombs as well. We rather like setting buildings on fire, and, you know, let's proceed and do just that. And so that was one of the things we had to stop and control. And to that extent, I suppose, that if you draw up soldiers and you send them charging into a crowd to try and pick up ringleaders, that, I suppose, is not necessarily operating exactly within the law, but it is a requirement to try and prevent looting, civil disorder, etc.
Is it your view, then, that some of the rioters were primarily concerned with personal gain, with looting, rather than with pursuing a political grievance?
Very difficult question to answer. I just don't know, because Londonderry, as you probably know, in those days, I don't know what the mix is now, in those days, the population mix was the exact opposite of the province as a whole. Mm-hmm. We were 70% Roman Catholic and 30% Protestant. A great chunk of the Roman Catholic lot were in the ghetto areas, let's call them, of the Bogside and the Cregan. They regarded themselves as second-class citizens because they said they'd been treated as second-class citizens. It's back to what civil rights was all about. I can only say that my observation is they had a point. My observation is that I can think of street corners where people stood unemployed with nothing to go and do. Their fathers, their grandfathers, and probably their great-grandfathers had stood on exactly the same corner, also with nothing to do. The unemployment rate was very high in Londonderry at that time. I forget the exact percentage, but something like 19% or something. It was very high indeed. And with no obvious way of things improving. But having said that, the Lord Mayor and the corporation had been abolished and had been taken over by a development commission, which was an ad hoc body put together mixed religions, mixed abilities, mixed backgrounds of business and so on, which I thought was a highly successful and skillful body of people. But to take an example, I'm sorry, I'm hopping about all over the place, it's just as thoughts occur to me. To take an example, the vice chairman of that development commission was a Roman Catholic who came from Donegal, and his background was he was a fisherman's family from Donegal and lived in, you know, a tiny little cottage in Donegal. And before the troubles really got going in Londonderry, when I arrived there, we set out to have a fairly regular series of, let's call them drink parties, of a mixture of my own soldiers, most of whom were unaccompanied, local bigwigs of one sort or another, and local people of one sort or another. And we had to stop it fairly quickly doing this because I got involved in a lot of night duty and, you know, doing this and that. But we had this vice chairman to one of these dues, and he said, "Do you know, this is the first time in my life that I've been inside an establishment house, ever." And there he was, vice chairman of the Londonderry Development Commission, and a very respected local man. And the local Protestants just took no notice of him at all. Well, if you have that happening to a respected businessman, what's going to happen to the hoi polloi who live in the Bogside? And so, you know, it was an absolute example of what had been going on. Another example is Remembrance Sunday. I'm now talking of Remembrance Sunday in 1971, I think it was, not 70. No, it must have been 70. And I think I'm right in saying the Prime Minister of Northern Ireland came.
Would that be Captain O'Neill at that time?
No, that being...
Chichester Clark?
Chichester Clark. And he came in his, you know, his usual get-up for a remembrance service. But he was the first minister to have come to Londonderry from Stormont for 6 months or whatever. And yet Londonderry was one of the key places for them to do something about. And, you know, as an outsider, I noticed all these things and wasn't slow to comment on them. But the interesting thing is that, and to an extent, this is to an extent it's special pleading, but not wholly, that I don't think that the Belfast military side wholly understood the difference between Belfast and Londonderry, or west of the ban, generally.
Are you saying that the people out at
Lisburn
were not really in touch with what was going on in your particular area?
No, I'm not saying they weren't in touch. I think they knew what was happening. Mm. I don't think, and I, as I say, to an extent it's special pleading, but I don't think that deep down they actually appreciated the difference between their neck of the woods and my neck of the woods.
Well, if one looks at Northern Ireland, you can say that really it's very much a mosaic, and that Belfast is distinct from Londonderry, but Londonderry then is distinct from Strabane, which is just down the road.
Yes.
And again, they're nothing like South Armagh or South Tyrone, are they? Each area.
They're all different.
Has its own character, particularly the temperament and outlook of the local population.
Yes.
And the mixture.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with all that. But in military terms,
yes,
and to an extent political terms, and looking at it from a Lisburn point of view, I think... I think that the difference between the Belfast end and all the other places you've mentioned is the significant difference. The differences between those other individual places, I don't think, are quite so significant as the difference between the Belfast end and them. I may be quite wrong, but I...
But this is a difference, really, which is political and cultural, isn't it, rather than... military in a strict sense.
Oh, absolutely so. Oh, completely different, yes. But I'm thinking now in terms of how one operates in the situation in which you find yourself. And I happen to think that you have to be sensitive to the local scene rather than just saying, well, you know, what we're going on with in Northern Ireland is so-and-so.
Wasn't there a similar situation to a certain extent in Malaya, where each little state, as the Malayan Federation, had its own character and its own population mix and its own circumstances?
I suppose, yes. But speaking for myself personally, I mean, that particular difference never came my way.
Because you were just in one area, really,
that's
weren't
right,
you?
Yes.
What did you see as being the main threat then? Was it a question of political agitation and large-scale disorder?
In Londonderry, yes, when I first got there. In Omagh, I can't tell you, because every time I talked to the commanding officer there and said, tell me what's happening, tell me what threat is, etc., etc., he said, I can't identify one. Armagh... bandit country, hackles up the back of your neck as you walk down the road, wondering if you're going to be shot the next step or whatever.
When did the shooting start? Because, as I understand it, when the army first arrived, and started separating the mobs in Belfast. They were treated as rescuers.
But saviours, yes. And in Londonderry,
yes,
too.
Yes, and in Londonderry as well. And then there was a period in which gradually the local population, elements of the local population, came to regard the army as the enemy.
Correct.
As opposed to the other community.
Correct.
And then the terrorist organisation, taking advantage of that shift, started the campaign of shooting and bombing, with their emphasis upon attacking the army and the police rather than the other side, as it were.
Yes.
Did you see that process happening at the time, or is it something one can only see with hindsight?
Well, it's very interesting, this, because Anthony Farrar-Hockley became the CLF, and he is very much a doer, as you probably know, and he reckoned, I think he reckoned he was God's greatest gift to the intelligence world, etc. He knew exactly what was going to happen and what the IRA was going to be up to. I think, to an extent, that's true. But he kept on... Oh, I've got that. I'm sorry.
Carry on.
I can't remember where I got to.
You were saying that Tony Farrar-Hockley thought he knew what was going to happen.
But you see, I'm now well into 1971.
Yes.
And the first bullet in Londonderry was in July 1971.
Yes.
And indeed, I was standing on the square at what had been Sea Eagle, and by that time was Ebrington Barracks.
Mm.
And I heard a Tommy gun across the water, and I thought, you know, this is it. It's now gone. We've lost it.
Mm.
And things got worse from that minute onwards. Mm. But up till that minute, we hadn't had a gun in Londonderry at all. And every so often, Farrar-Hockley was saying, all his briefings, he's saying, now look, the IRA are about to do X, Y, and Z. You must know what's happening in your area. You must have heard something. And so I religiously had my commanding officers' conferences and said, what's happening in Armagh, what's happening in Omagh, what's happening in Londonderry, etc., etc. And they all firmly denied any knowledge of IRA activity at all, which is very interesting. And so I reported this to Northern Ireland headquarters and was told, more or less told, you're a bloody fool, what's that effect? And of course, as it turned out, they were quite right. But I could not identify actual IRA activity stirring things or taking over in Londonderry or Omagh or wherever, and nor could the commanding officers, nor could the intelligence people.
What about the police?
No, I'm talking including the police.
Including the police,
yeah,
yes.
Including the police, which is very odd.
Who was doing your intelligence work for you at local level, at brigade level?
Well, we had a military intelligence officer. I forget what their title was now, but there were a couple of them scattered about. We talked regularly to the special branch man in Londonderry and the special branch men in the other places, and they absolutely could not tell us. And so we had to say, look, I'm sorry, there is no evidence. We cannot support what you're telling us. And, you know, we cannot, as a result, produce any counter-operations. Mm. And so I suppose, to an extent, we got taken for a ride.
When that shooting did occur in July, did it come as a shock to you and
yes.
as a surprise to you?
It did indeed. A great shock.
Mm.
And I can remember a sort of frisson as I was standing on the square there saying, oh God, we've lost it.
Mm.
And indeed, from that minute onwards, although we hadn't lost it immediately, we were all right for about another month, but that was quickly followed by internment in August. And from that minute on, we'd absolutely lost it.
Internment in August 1971?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What sort of operations do you think might have been effective against the shooting threat that developed in the summer of 1971?
Well, I mean, there was just the one incident, yeah. And that was it.
Mm.
Well, now, obviously, I mean, up till that minute, the soldiers were all very carefully briefed that, you know, there is no shooting in Londonderry. I mean, that's your basic starting point when you come here. And they were very carefully briefed about operations in Londonderry and mobile operations and foot operations and so on. And although some of these people were, you know, coming only for a 4-month tour, they were very, very good about the way they carried out their orders. I mean, very, very responsive indeed. And having got the gun having come out, obviously we relaxed things a little bit and said, well, you know, obviously you shoot in self-defense, etc. Mm-hmm. Yellow card and all that. And I can remember saying to John Hume, I said, you know, there's going to be a problem. Somebody is bound to get shot. And indeed, a soldier did shoot two Londonderry citizens shortly afterwards. And there was a frightful hoo-ha. They were unarmed, etc., etc. And the soldier said, I mean, I thought I was going to be shot, and I shot them. Mm. And he was within his rights. And, I mean, all I said was, well, naturally we're going to support the soldier, but there must be an inquest. And there was an inquest, and it didn't happen for a long, long time. And by that time, things had got worse again. And so, you know, we never really cleared up that particular episode.
What happened to the soldier? Was he exonerated, or was he blamed for...
I think he was exonerated. But by that time, I mean, by the time I left Londonderry, which was in November 71, I can only say it was in a good deal worse state than it was when I got there, which is a terrible thing to have to say. But it's the way life went.
Now, you mentioned having dealings with John Hume. How did you find him as a man to deal with?
I admire him enormously. I think he's very brave. How he's survived all this time, I really don't know. I think he's absolutely exhausted. But I've always found him straightforward to deal with. I don't suppose we'd ever be friends. I don't suppose he probably would ever trust me properly. I don't know. But I always tried to play fair in the city of Londonderry. I mean, I always say that if I'd still been there, there would not have been a bloody Sunday, because I can't conceive it could have happened in my time. But equally, things had changed, so, you know, who knows?
You mentioned also earlier on dealing with the press and the media. Now, the press and the media are often blamed for complicating military operations and policing in turbulent circumstances. Do you think that's reasonable? Did you find them a nuisance, or can you conceive of ways in which they were an asset to you?
I don't think I go so far as to say they were an asset, because, I mean, inevitably, their needs and mine were different. Inevitably. It's a difficult question to answer, because I've always worked with the press on the basis that I trust them till they let me down. And once they've let me down, I never talk to that particular one again, ever. And indeed, I can think of a man on the Times I shall never talk to again. Nothing to do with Northern Ireland at all. But he let down somebody else. I can remember, I was late one night, I was out doing, you know, just wandering round, as commanders tend to do. And I met a man from the Daily Mirror. And he said, what on earth are you doing here at this time of night? And I said, I'm talking to my soldiers, thank you very much. What are you doing here? And, you know, we had a chatty little conversation, and then he pushed off. On the whole, I found them okay, but just occasionally. They were very tiresome. And as far as the local press was concerned, I mean, the... what's it called, the newsletter, and those sort of papers, I mean, I regard them as extreme, and I never got involved with the editors or with the journalists.
You mentioned so far just the print media. What about television and radio? Did you make a distinction between them and the journalists writing for newspapers?
No,